but rich are heavily financing politicians to tell people that they're suffering because of people who are suffering even more than they are.
Storytelling for social change, only on KPFA.
This is 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, everywhere at kpfa.org.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Israeli occupation forces expand their attacks in the West Bank with heavily armed illegal settlers. We'll speak with Ziad Abbas, executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Also, poet and child psychotherapist Anita Burrows will share her latest poems from the Gaza genocide, and nuclear madness at Diablo Canyon here in the Bay Area as the feds move to loosen the rules on nuke plants, even further endangering all of us. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Hope you can hear me okay. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We call it Flashpoints here on KPFA Pacifica Radio. Beautiful, beautiful radio station founded in 1949 by folks who understood how important it is to have a free speech, no holds barred, non-corporate, non-owned radio and media network to speak truth to power. And we continue that tradition from 1949 until now. Joining us is our good friend Ziad Abbas. He is the executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Ziad, I really wanted to have you on today because now we're focusing on the West Bank. The West Bank, about 8 or 10 times the size of the Gaza Strip. You know a great deal about what's going on there right now. It would be great if you could describe what the settlers are up to and what it's like to be forced to confront these folks who are on your land and in your houses. Tell us what you understand about what's happening these days in the West Bank.
Yeah, myself here, Dennis. Good evening, everyone. Yeah, it's the same, I can say, since over 1,000 days, since the beginning of genocide in Gaza. This is what's happening in West Bank, but the focus on news, it was in that period on Gaza Strip. But right now, it's West Bank become the center for the Israeli army, what they are doing and how they target Palestinians. You have their bulldozers everywhere in West Bank, destroying homes, destroying, uprooting trees, and you have their drones, not just in Gaza Strip, and bombing and killing. Like today, they killed 3 people inside Gaza Strip and 29 injured. Their drones, too, in West Bank now, following the Palestinians. They are watching Palestinian village farmers, watching Palestinian cities, and following the Palestinians. Sometimes target what they call it, wanted Palestinian, and they shoot them and they kill them. You have the Israeli army at the same time invading Palestinian cities, towns, villages, camps, etc., and arrest tens of people every night. This is part of the daily. Add to that, you have the seculars and their activity every day and almost every hour, I can say, in different parts of West Bank. And these kind of attacks become part of the daily life. Add to that, you have over 900 checkpoints inside West Bank. You have towns with gates where Israel blocked the close these gates. I speak, like, I know my area, Bethlehem. You have many villages around Bethlehem. Many people living in these villages, they are not able to reach the city because simply the Israelis, they close the gates and people, they cannot drive their cars. Add to that, the settlers, they are everywhere in the mountains, not just in the roads. Even in the other, what we call it, alternative ways for Palestinians where they can cross through some hills. settlers, they are everywhere there. And we can hear the story. We read. I speak with my family almost every day right now just to check on them. And all the time there are stories where their life can be in danger. And like last night, for example, last night for them, for us, where some houses set in fire by the settlers. Now I'm speaking with you, the Israeli army imposed the curfew in a town called Beit Umar. It's between Bethlehem and Hebron. And this town all the time targeted. Now imposed the curfew, tens of military jeeps and military tanks entering the village. And who knows what will happen there or how many people they will be arrested. Settlers at the same time, they are attacking right now, tonight, like in Palestinian time, it's early morning. They are in many villages right now. For example, I say, Beit Dajan, you have Beit Porik, you have other villages around Salfit. Nablus area is still under siege, where the people, what happened like a few days ago, that the four Palestinians, they were killed by the settlers and by the Israeli army. And these settlers, and here I'm not speaking about like you speak tens of settlers, hundreds of settlers where they targeted the villages and set houses on fire. And we saw that. It was all over social media about that. This is the picture what's going on in West Bank. I don't want to say it's an escalation, but I can say this is part of the daily life. Palestinian right now, it's many of them, it is hard for them to move from their village to the city, from city to the city. And in a way or another, Israelis, they speak a lot about annexation. Like, for Palestinians now in West Bank, they consider it the annexation already happened because the implementation on the ground, how many Israeli army units, they are everywhere controlling everything in the Palestinian daily life. And the annexation already happened. The only what they are missing is the official announcement. Now, what will happen? This is the big question. People in there, like when you speak with them on the ground there, family or friends or our colleagues at work in West Bank, they are expecting a lot of things. They are thinking like this. Maybe someday you will wake up or the news will come, a massacre happening in this village or in this town by the settlers. And here you speak about settlers. They are already protected by Israeli army. Settlers doesn't move alone. They have the Israeli army all the time protecting them. And this is what happened in Tel village near Nablus when they killed the four Palestinians. And the choices for Palestinians living in West Bank is very limited. Very limited how they want to defend, because it's not just they are defending their land when they attack their farms. They are attacking their house while they are sleeping inside. And these people, they try to protect their families, their children. They try to protect themselves. And these are the choices. And what will happen to the Palestinian? This is a big question. And the coming few days, it will be clear for us. It's a scary time in West Bank. And it's the international, I can say, public opinion not paying enough attention on that. And I'm speaking here about Palestinian. If you speak about Palestinian land, Israel is expanding settlements everywhere. The last 2 days only, just I'm saying, for example, the last 2 days, in 48 hours, 13 settlements outposts. And when I say settlements outposts, where a group of settlers or a few of settlers, they come, they set up their own tent. This tent later become a room, and the room grow up. Later, they open the infrastructure, a road to these mountains, and become a settlement. And this is now 13, just in the last 2 days. In addition to that, what Israeli government, they are planning to expand settlements in all over West Bank. They speak about it in very clear, if we follow what Israeli, this government, what they speak, they speak about, they want to control over 82% of West Bank. Actually, they are controlling all West Bank, because they control the air, they control the roads, and they control the water. They control the movement for the people, and they control the people if they want to travel outside, etc. People not allowed to get to Jerusalem, etc. So this is the reality right now in West Bank.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Ziad Abbas. He's the Executive Director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Right now we're talking about the occupied West Bank, where Ziad is from and knows a great deal about it. I think, Ziad, the first time we heard your voice over these airwaves, that was the night or the day you were with the kids singing in the trenches, ducking from fire. And that's why I'm coming back to you today, because you're somebody who knows the situation in the West Bank, and it really is substantial in the sense that this is a much bigger area, and the Israelis and the U.S. and the Israelis have their eyes on seizing this land and turning it into more occupied Israel. So, I mean, what's happening now with the West Bank is quite scary and dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. United States government, with all the support of the Israeli government, unleashed this government to do what they want to do. We saw what they did, and still ongoing genocide in Gaza Strip and ethnic cleansing. And in Gaza, this is another story. I don't want to. They set up like yellow line, and the yellow line is moving in Gaza. People, they are displaced again and again, because the yellow line where this is the area is controlling. And this yellow line is moving and pushing the people moving like toward. Now Israel, almost 70% of Gaza Strip under their control. And they cut the area, and they are building walls inside Gaza. When I say building walls, not by concrete, they build it by dares, make huge hills to separate areas in Gaza Strip. At the same time, USA continue to support and ignore what Israel doing inside West Bank. USA unleashed Israel, the Israeli government unleashed the settlers and their army, and they are attacking everyone in Palestine, in every village. And when you speak about settlers, don't forget the last 3 years. According to the statistics coming from inside Israel, over 350,000 Israelis already armed by the Israeli government. These settlers, they are living in West Bank, all of them armed. You speak about 650,000 settlers living in West Bank. They are already armed, but 350,000 gave them more arms inside West Bank. And these settlers right now, they are more organized. We are not speaking about random attacks. This is a systematic between the Israeli government and the settlers to target Palestinian people, to target Palestinian land, and push the Palestinian as much as they can to push the Palestinian to leave. And this is go back to 1948. It's very clear. This is how the Zionist movement implement this policy, that they want this land without Palestinian. And what they are doing right now, attacking like Palestinian farmers, Palestinian villagers, Palestinian camps, Palestinian cities, it's like in every aspect in their daily life. I know it's summer right now, no schools, but we know when there is a school, many, many schools, they are already students. They cannot reach their schools because the settlers, like what we see in Sefer Yatta, in Hebron, or in Salfit area, or around Nablus in these villages, the schools will come back. It will not be able to, the students to reach their schools, some of the students, I can say. In add to that, the Israel has now published a lot of orders to destroy houses. They find their own excuses, including today, actually, in the media. There is a Zeref school in Yatta, near Safar Yatta in Hebron. They gave them an order, and 250 girls, they will not be in a school in September when they go back. So they are. This is how it is. The United States, they don't pay attention. I know Netanyahu right now in the United States, and they give them this green light. Israel is still able, like no one hold them accountable, despite what the international court decide, etc. This did not reduce what Israel is doing for the Palestinians in the ground right now.
All right. Before we have a few more minutes, and I wanted to bring you back to Gaza, because as you say, what's going on there, I mean, we see a genocide full force expanding, and now they really are cutting up the Gaza Strip in a new way. At this point, my understanding is that the Israelis essentially control most of the Gaza Strip, and they've got it shredded and into a new sort of set of zones. What's going on there, Ziad? How are they cutting it up, and what are they up to?
Absolutely. In Gaza Strip right now, I want to share this story. We have our staff members in Gaza Strip. We have staff members in West Bank. So today I was speaking with one of our staff members in West Bank and asked about the situation, and she told me like this. She was speaking with her colleague in Gaza, and her colleague Wafa in Gaza, she was telling her what she heard in the news, watching that the situation is really very bad in West Bank. And my colleague from West Bank, she said, come on, when someone tell you that the situation in West Bank is really bad, it means, right, because the people living in the very bad situation in Gaza, it means really it's very bad in West Bank. Gaza Strip is forgotten, to be honest with you, Dennis. And right now you have communities, they are moving from area to other area. You have a disease spread everywhere right now because people, they are living in tents. It's very hot there right now. People, they are out of clean water. This is part of our work, but we cannot cover enough. People are still struggling in their daily life to get food, to survive. And you have the drones all the time and the shelling coming from the Israeli tanks. 3 people killed. Right now we are speaking about over 73,000 people already killed in Gaza itself, and over 1,211 people killed since the ceasefire until now. And the people, they are struggling. And it's scary. Israel pushing the people right now. You speak about over 2 million people. They are living in 30% of Gaza Strip. And Israel, what I said in the beginning, the yellow line, pushing the Palestinian more and more. For us, there are certain area where our water trucks and sometimes distributing food, parcels, etc. Right now, we are not able because the yellow line moved and the people already evacuated, pushed out of that area. And people still living, you speak about 1.7 million, they are living in tents. And most of them, they are moving. And now the people, they are worried where we will go, 30%, and what will happen. And still Israel, they are allowing that only around 20-25% of the people needs in Gaza Strip to get in. I mean, between food, and I speak about some necessities for the people to survive, which is not enough in Gaza.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are speaking with Ziad Abbas of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Ziad, before we let you go, you want to talk a little bit about maybe what actions, what kinds of things MEC is involved with now? Are there any things you'd like to share with us in terms of programs or things going on?
Yeah, absolutely. We have actually, we MECA still, we are able, fortunate, we are very fortunate still, we are working in Gaza Strip and in West Bank. Yes. And in West Bank, in Gaza Strip, we are still our kitchen, our water. We ask the people to still, first to take actions. We want the people to take action to stop, reach out to the representative to do whatever they can to stop this genocide in Gaza Strip and what the Israel is, the ethnic cleansing inside West Bank by the Israeli army and Israeli settlers. At the same time, we want the people to continue to support us and donate and help us to continue to do the work inside. They can go to our website and learn about the work. And we have our coming event, actually. They can go to our website and learn about this event. It's with Adam Johnson, How You Sell Genocide. And we will have it on August 13th here in Mecca. People, they can go to the website and sign. It's free, but we need to, they can RCVB in our website. This is a very important event to learn about how the media treating the genocide in Gaza Strip.
And are the boats continuing? Are there still independent boats and independent materials arriving? What is the actual struggle on the ground? Are they getting just a small percentage of what they need in terms of things coming in through trucks?
Israel is still controlling many. There is a lack of everything, but the most important thing is there is a lack of medicine. When I speak about different kinds of diseases spread among the people, inside living in tents. And still, the people, they need medicine. They need material to clean up around, because they have different kind of flies, different kind of animals right now growing up in this reality and attack them in their tents. At the same time, these are not available inside Gaza Strip. There are certain kind of medicine, and there are certain kind of needs for children. You speak about like over 50,000 women pregnant inside Gaza. These women, they cannot access their own needs inside Gaza. All of this kind of things is missing, and many, many other things it's necessary for the people to survive inside Gaza. Unfortunately, the international community, they are not putting any kind of pressure on Israel to allow these kind of necessities get inside Gaza. Dennis, we are right now coming close to 3 years of genocide. The other day, in one day, they succeed. Slowly, slowly, the community, with the small machines they have, to get 99 Palestinian bodies under a big building, and so they were killed over 2 years ago. And this is still in many, we speak about Gaza, you have over 9,500 people, they are disappeared. This is the statistics speaks about coming from Gaza resources. But the numbers can be more than this. And still you have these bodies still spread everywhere. And these bodies can create more disease for the people around inside Gaza Strip. This is the reality.
It's amazing. There. It's unbelievable what a reality it is, created by U.S. tax dollars, and the flow of weapons continues unabated, and the suffering is just extraordinary. We appreciate our long-term relationship with the Middle East Children's Alliance. Ziad Abbas is the executive director, and you could hear that his experience is firsthand. This is his country, it's the violence is unbelievable. Ziad, I hope we can obviously continue this dialogue, and obviously we're always here if you need to get the word out. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Matt.
You're absolutely welcome. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. What I want to do here now, dear engineer, is take a musical break, and then when we come back, we're going to bring in Anita Barrows, has been writing a poem every single day of this genocide. Anita Barrows, master poet, translator of Rilke, a psychotherapist for children, very troubled children, has been writing a poem every single day of this genocide. And we're going to continue the sharing of those poems. So stay with us.
One morning I woke up and I knew it was all. A new day, a new way, and new eyes for all. Go your way, I'll go mine, and the sky.
Yes, let's bring it down and bring her in. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And this is your daily investigative news magazine. We have been covering the genocide in Gaza for as long as this program has been on the air. And that's about 40 years now, in one form or another. And the suffering, Anita, continues apace. You have been doing an amazing thing in writing one of these powerful poems every single day of the suffering, documenting this genocide. It will be one day a very big collection and an important collection, a document. You talk about information. How do we're journalists, we report Well, the reporting that you've been doing in these poems is extraordinary. And the fact that you're now teaching kids in Gaza in a poetry workshop in the context of a genocide is quite amazing, inspiring. And we're happy that we can share some of that experience with you. Anita, welcome. What day is this? Do we have
today,
a poem?
Yeah, we do. It's day 1027. It's unimaginable. Unimaginable. But we have today's poem, and it's with thanks to Dr. Dorotea Guchardo, who Nora interviewed on the Electronic Intifada last week, and it was on Flashpoints. So here we go, day 1027. No more than 2 years old, possibly, given the levels of starvation, 2.5. She's walking alone on the ruined road, shoulders hunched, back stooped, carrying a heavy jug of water, her little arms bent backward over her head to secure it. We don't know who may have sent her, a mother who just gave birth to her sibling, a father whose legs were blown off in a bombing. We don't know how many times she has walked this same road to get water for her family, how many times she's been fixed in the sniper's eye, the quadcopter's vicious aim. We don't know what the weight of the jug carried day after day will do to her spine, or how many more times she'll survive this errand. It's just unimaginable. Little two-year-old sent to get water for her family, most likely because there was no one else.
I hear these stories coming in, and you know, from various sources, including the Electronic Intifada, and I find myself screaming.
Yes.
No, how can you can't? No, you're not doing this to people.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's just unbearable. And the stories of the children, you know, certainly because I work with children and because I'm a mother and a grandmother, the stories of children are the ones that just, you know, tear me apart. And writing about it, bearing witness to it, feels like the only thing I can do.
Yeah. So you're doing a lot, and read us another one of yours, and then I'd like to spend a minute or two talking about your students, and maybe we can hear one of their poems. Okay, but why don't you give us another?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
I will read yesterday's, day 1026. Their bodies charred, unable to be identified except for the sizes of the children, length of a six-year-old, length of a nine-year-old, an 11-year-old, charred like trees, like a grove of trees that yesterday was green and leafy, a family asleep, now dead, who in the evening had been alive, children playing, unrecognizable now, except for how long the shrouds are, shrouds wound around ash, their laughter, ash. Their love for each other, ash. Their studying, ash. Their tenderness, their fear, their singing, their arguments, their desires, their teasing, their dreaming, ash. That was a whole family that was killed in their sleep in Almawasi.
Wow.
About a week ago. Yeah, four children and their parents.
Wow.
Just unbearable, and Israel keeps inflicting it. I mean, people I know who watch and listen to only mainstream media say, you know, why are you still writing these poems? Isn't there a ceasefire? Isn't the genocide over? And not only is it not over, it has gotten more intense. I heard from one of my students today that one of the tactics Israel is using now is freezing bank accounts so that people cannot access their money to buy the basic staples of life. This happened to my student and her father. And all of a sudden, they have no money to buy groceries with, such groceries as there are, which are not many to begin with. And it's just one tactic after the next designed to wipe out a people. Shall I read another one?
Yes, please. Yeah,
and then we can maybe read the poem by this amazing young kid that I'm working with in Gaza. So this is day 1024. Their bodies were found together, the two sisters whose laughter the family in the next tent had been hearing the night before. Their bodies, stiff and cold and covered with blood, when only the night before they'd been dancing to music from their brother's phone and calling for others to join them. How is it possible they're dead? Their voices, their wild joy despite everything, they'd been so alive. Now they are being wrapped in white shrouds. Now the earth is being prepared to receive them. Now their mother will live the rest of her life hearing the shots that killed them.
Oh, powerful. Mm. Let's talk a little bit about how you evolved to be teaching having some students in Gaza, young students in what is really, I guess it's a poetry workshop, or I'm not even sure how to characterize what you've been up to with these young poets in Gaza. But tell us about it. And I know you've got a poem. I hope you do. One of their poems.
I do. Yeah, I have an amazing poem.
Talk about it, though. Talk about this process.
Yeah, so it's a wonderful organization that I'm volunteering with. It's called We Are Not Numbers. It was founded by, among others, Dr. Rashad Alarir, who was due to speak on Flashpoints, I think the day he ended up being assassinated by Israel. He was a very well-known poet and a professor of English literature at the Islamic University of Gaza in Gaza City. In fact, the student who's poem I'm going to read had taken a class with him and had been looking forward to taking more classes with him. Anyway, he and a group of others, about 15 years ago at least, founded We Are Not Numbers, the name being self-explanatory, to help young poets and storytellers as well, prose writers in Gaza, be mentored by writers in the English-speaking world. They were very encouraging that the students write in English because they felt that English would reach a wide audience, and the kids in Gaza learn English pretty early in their schooling when they have schooling, but in any case, they pair writers with mentors, and sometimes it's a one-off relationship, and you work with a student on a particular piece, and then that's done, and you work with other people. But sometimes the relationships last, and I have a group of students now with whom the relationship has lasted. And this one young woman, Taqwa Ahmed Alwawi, who just turned 20 a couple of months ago, began writing poetry shortly after I started mentoring her. She came to the project with a prose piece, and I worked with her on that. And then she began reading the daily poems that my daughter posts on on the website, poemsforgaza.com, the poems I write, and Takwa said, would you be willing to work with me on my poems? I'm just beginning to write poetry. And this kid who was just beginning to write poetry about a year and a half ago is now, I think, a phenomenal, phenomenal poet. And she's writing and she's helping to support her family with her writing. She sells her articles to various places around the world, Mondo Weiss, and she's had some pieces in the Electronic Intifada, actually. And with what she gets paid, she helps support her family. She has several brothers and sisters. So I'm going to read this poem that she and I have been working on together. I've given her suggestions and written to her about why these particular suggestions, the poem is hers. It's extraordinary. And she names a group of friends, which you'll hear shortly into the poem. The poem is called 6:30, like 6:30 on the clock. Count with me. 1, the clock stopped. 2, I did not notice. 3, the world kept moving. 4, I stayed behind. 5, Shima. 6, Raghad. 7, Mayar. 8, Naveen, Asma, Fatima. 9, Abd al-Salam, Hutaifa, Allah, 10, Asma. Now count again, but slower. 1, they were here. 2, they are not. 3, I am still here. 4, I do not know why. 5, I write their names. 6, the names do not bring them back. 7, I write them anyway. 8, because if I stop. 9, they die again. 10, and I cannot bury them twice. Do you understand now? The clock is not broken. It is simply stuck. The world does not wait. It is still moving, but I am not in it. I am in 15th October. I am in 16th October. I am in 31st October. I am in 1st November. I am in 30th December. I am in 24th May. I am in 6 dates. I am 6 wounds. I am 6 reasons the clock is stalled. It will never move again. All of them, they did not speak. They did not need to. They pointed forward, and I understood. Do not say they died. Say they are ahead of me. Say they won. Say I am still running. Say I will catch up. Say the race is not over. Say I will not stop. The world asks me, what time is it? I look at the clock. I look at my hands. I look at the names on my skin. I answer, it is 6:30. It will always be 6:30 because time does not move forward. It stops with them. And I am still running. I am still running. I am still running until I catch up.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that is, tell us again, that's one of your students from Gaza. And is that part of a collection now?
She's putting together a collection. And I want to see this collection published not just in Gaza. I want to see it published here. I think that her poetry is so extraordinary. And I know I've said this before on the air. If she survives, and, you know, as you can see from that poem, nobody in Gaza can fully believe that they will survive. But if they do, if she does, I think she will be one of the great poets of the Palestinian people. She's extraordinary.
Can we figure out a way to have her come and read in Berkeley? Maybe it could be part of a publication ceremony of her first book.
Inshallah. Inshallah. You know, Gaza, Israel is not even letting kids who have cancer and who are going to die unless they get treated an hour away from where they live. They're not even letting those people outside Gaza right now.
They're killing. It's a killing machine. All the different ways you can kill people. That's what's happening in Gaza. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, and that's my, you know, the calls come around the clock. The suffering is immense, and it's not getting any better.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not getting any better. It's getting more intense, and they're finding new ways, like freezing people's bank accounts, to exterminate people. I mean, there are so many ways to exterminate people. The official count, the 73,000 dead, is just the count of the people who they know have been killed by bombs or you know, other implements, drones, quadcopters. But the people who are still buried under the rubble and the people who have died of starvation and the people who have died because they have no access to medication, it's got to be at least 200,000.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, would you like to share, do you have a couple more of your own that you'd like to share with us? We'd like to hear them.
Absolutely. This is day 1021. This is for a boy named Ayahem. The boy, 13, went to the market to buy what he could for his family. When he returned, his whole family, parents, siblings, had been killed. Instead of being received with happy smiles for the peaches, the zucchini, he was met by shrouds, some of them small. His youngest sister, which was his mother, which was his father, confused, in shock, the boy looked around. People had gathered, were standing, looking. They were standing around him, behind him, their hands on his head, his back, his shoulders. Who will eat these fruits and vegetables now, he was thinking. And how is it that I'm the only one alive? This is day 1020. This is a record of how they were killed. He was standing on the roof of his house. His house was still standing. She was bringing a bucket of water to her grandmother's tent next to hers. She was sitting in her tent, reading a book she'd read 20 times before, the one book she had. He was combing his younger brother's hair. He was climbing a tree barren of leaves to see if he could see his father walking back from where he had gone for food. He was taking his first steps across from his uncle, his one surviving relative. She was doing arithmetic homework assigned by her teacher, who had been teaching children in a tent with workbooks she made herself. The child was subtracting two-digit numbers from other two-digit numbers when suddenly she was shot in the neck. Then she herself had to be subtracted from the group who met in the teacher's tent later that day. Count the hours, the minutes, count the children, count the bullets.
Listening to Flashpoints, that is our good friend Anita Barros, who has written a poem for every day of this genocide. The poetry is extraordinary, and we have been featuring it on Flashpoints over the last many weeks and months. Very fortunate to have it, and people again have asked, well, this is a news magazine, and you know, right. This is this Flashpoints. I think we believe in the open flow of information and as much of it as possible. And one way to get extraordinary information, it's not journalism, it's called poetry and storytelling. And there's that combination. And what we're hearing of these poems that we've been sharing with Anita and her poems has been really inspirational to many people. We've gotten many responses, and we appreciate that. Maybe a final poem for this segment,
great.
Anita.
Great. And I will say these are all news stories. All of the poems I write come from real stories. They're just ways of making them very personal and bringing out the feeling. So this one was actually told by Dr. Mimi Syed, who is a Palestinian-American emergency room doctor who spent some time working in Gaza at various hospitals with children and wrote an extraordinary paper recently with a few other contributors about how children are deliberately targeted by Israeli quadcopters. So this is a poem based on a story she told about a girl named Mira. Mira was playing by herself on the morning of her older sister's birthday. Mira, then 4. Her parents were trying to make a cake. They were going to celebrate, though it was in the middle of a genocide, though they had been displaced, though they were living in a tent and not in a house. 4. Playing just outside the tent by herself, thinking about the sweet cake they would eat, the songs they would sing to her sister. That's when the quadcopter began hovering over her like a bird of prey. That's when it stopped, took aim like a hawk, a vulture, ready to kill, to consume. That's when the bullet sent by the soldier nowhere in sight lodged in her brain. Mira, 4 years old. That's when she fell, miraculously still breathing. That's when everything went blank. No more birthday cake, no more songs. And I have to say, Mimi Syed operated on Mira, removed the bullet from her brain, and Mira has been medically evacuated with her mother and is recovering from her injuries and will be all right.
That is an extraordinary way to end this segment. Anita, as always, we are amazed by the work you've been doing, the way you've documented this genocide, a poem every day of these killing fields, and they do continue. And it is mind-boggling. The suffering that's being caused that doesn't have to happen is just every day I wake up and I think, no, it couldn't be. Well, why would human beings do this to each other? But this is what's going on now. Thank you for documenting it. And obviously, we're going to continue our dialogue. We're going to have somewhere in the future, we're going to have a beautiful celebration. We're going to honor the work you're doing, and we're going to make this these poems that you're doing. They're up at a website now. People can get the complete work so far, right? They're available?
Yes, exactly. My amazing daughter, Nora Barrows-Friedman, has set up a website. It's poemsforgaza.com. And we have a little assembly line. I write the poem and she posts it.
So it all right. Well, I wanted people to know it is up. If it is available, if you want it, and we're going to keep working with Anita, and we really want this genocide to end. That would be a great thing, a great celebration. End the genocide. Anyway, we're going to have to end the segment now. Thank you, Anita. Everybody, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a bit of an extended music break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Harvey Wasserman, and he's going to be talking about some nuclear insanity that's emerging around, you guessed it, Diablo Canyon. here in Northern California. Dangerous place to be. Stay with us. Beautiful. Thank you. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, your daily investigative news magazine, welcoming back to these airwaves our good friend, Harvey Wasserman, longtime environmentalist, Solartopia, many books on the subject, out on the front lines, fighting the good fight against the nuclear madness. But the madness continues, Harvey Wasserman. Why should we be concerned about places like Diablo Canyon? You got Trump's in charge. Well, Dennis, what's there to worry about?
You and I have been talking for decades. I'm going to give you the scariest sentence you ever heard. The entire 100% health and safety regulation of all 94 atomic reactors in the United States, including the two at Diablo Canyon, are now solely and 100% in the charge of Donald Trump. The Swada decision from the Supreme Court of the United States says that the President of the United States, whoever it might be at the time, can fire without cause any regulator. That means that Donald Trump, who has personal, very large personal financial investments in the nuclear power industry, is now 100% in charge of the safety regulations at Diablo Canyon and all the other nuclear power plants in the United States. So these two reactors at San Luis Obispo, which everybody is telling us, oh, they're so safe, they're so heavily regulated, Donald Trump can fire any member of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff that might give a peep about maybe, oh, you know, San Andreas, could turn that place to rubble, or, you know, the pipes are corroded, or it's embrittled. Anyone who dares to say such a thing, Donald Trump will send them to Siberia. So, you know, that's the situation we're now in, Dennis. It's probably the worst moment in the history of American atomic power. Donald Trump, 100% in charge of all nuclear regulation, and Gavin Newsom running around telling us that Diablo Canyon is safe, while he's also attacking Donald Trump. Come on, Gavin. Who's in charge of the safety there?
What scares you most about Diablo Canyon? And what, in real terms, what's the concern?
The San Andreas. I mean, everybody who knows anything about earthquakes knows that the San Andreas is headed for a fall. And those two reactors are going to turn to rubble immediately, and total radiation all over the place. We saw it four times at Fukushima, slightly different causes at Chernobyl. But we have known for decades what can happen with an earthquake at Diablo Canyon. There are a dozen earthquake faults there, those reactors will just crumble into nothing. Aside from the fact that they're breaking us economically. Yeah, Diablo Canyon is an incredibly expensive piece of garbage that is costing us at least $1 billion a year over what our budget should be in California, and the incredible breakthroughs that are happening, Dennis. If there's any miracle in our time, it's been the advance of solar, wind, geothermal, and now
battery. All right, let's go there. Let's go there for a little bit. Tell us about the solartopian world, what we should be doing, what it should look like. Where we could be.
Well,
aren't we desperate? Don't we need this nuclear power? We really need it, don't we?
I,
Right now, it's fulfilling a need.
Well, you can join me. Go every night tonight to YouTube and look at what's happening in the solar industry and the wind industry, especially in the battery industry. The breakthroughs in renewable energy are just spectacular. And the cost savings that we would get from shutting Diablo are enormous. Our electric rates in California would go down 25-30% immediately if they shut the Diablo and made the conversion to renewables, because that the technology is the miracle of our lifetime. It has expanded so rapidly and dropped in price so radically that it's a joke. The idea that they would run those two reactors is such a ripoff. It's all going straight into the hands of the people at PG&E are sponsoring Gavin Newsom's run for president. It's ridiculous. There is zero, and there's every economic reason to shut those reactors right away. Economically, even if they weren't rated, even if they're 100% safe, Diablo Canyon would be just the biggest ripoff in the history of California. It's incredibly, it makes no sense economically. And heap on that the incredible disaster that would accompany the earthquake that we all know is coming, and then multiply that with the fact that Donald Trump will be in charge of the evacuation. I mean, really, come on. You know, Donald Trump is literally in charge of the health and safety at Diablo Canyon. Just let that sink in for a minute.
Well, I bet you he'd get out of there first if there was a problem.
He'd have
an exit plan.
You know, these are hideous beasts. These people, they have zero compassion, zero empathy, and no care whatsoever for the health and safety of the general public, which they seem to omit actually includes them. I mean, they think they're a different species, I suppose, but this Dennis has never been more dangerous than it is right now at Diablo Canyon. Add the fact
what should happen there? What exactly should happen? How should that break down? How should Diablo Canyon be gotten rid of? What would be the safest way? What needs to happen?
Jerry Brown laid it all out in 2016. It was signed, sealed, and delivered. Gavin Newsom was lieutenant governor. He signed on. And in 22, somebody handed him a check and picked up his tab at the French Gardener or whatever it was called. And he stabbed us in the back. The whole plan was laid out beautifully in 2016 to 2018. It was signed on by the unions, the local governments, the PUC, the assembly, the environmental groups, PG&E wanted to shut it down. It was all laid out perfectly, 2016 to 2018. And then in 22, Gavin stabbed us in the back. And there's no excuse for it. There's every very, very clear path to gradually phasing those reactors out and phasing in more rapidly than ever now the renewables. The lights will not flicker when we switch to renewables. We have seven times more battery storage capacity than the capacity of Diablo Canyon now. Battery storage has plummeted. Solar panels have plummeted. Wind power, geothermal, it's all right there. And we have the highest electric rates in the continental U.S. because Diablo Canyon continues to operate. It is absolutely of no value whatsoever to the well-being of the people.
Harvey Wasserman, people want to follow your work, want to follow Solartopia, want to know more about what you're up to. How do they do that, Harvey?
Yeah,
we're just about out of time.
Write me directly. Yes, write me. And Dennis, we featured you on our Monday calls, Monday 2 to 4 Pacific time. People email me directly, solartopia@gmail.com.
People can participate in it. This is like a Monday roundtable that you do, right, every Monday.
Yeah. It is. You've been a featured guest. We want you again. We'll be talking this coming Monday.
It's a great place to go to learn. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Dennis. Thanks,
friend. All right. Be safe.
You too.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're gone.
And that does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers, Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical producer, Rod Akil. Our theme music written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions and comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Bushman, ballot measures to tax billionaires, regulate dark money, and more. Join KPFA's Election Watch program, The Stakes, airing every Thursday at 10 a.m. and online anytime at kpfa.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
The following is brought to you by No One Trying to